Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of RomPod. I am your host, Amanda McCall. Are you ready to share the love? The show notes for each episode at rompod.com contain links to this and other stories by our featured authors, all of whom have generously agreed to share their stories with us for free. Please, support them in any way you can, like exploring more of their work. This week's story is by Howard McEwen, titled Macomb County Water Tower No. 2. Howard's interests include writing, beekeeping, and cocktails. And I don't know about you, but I certainly am looking forward to the last one. In addition to our featured story today, Howard has quite a few short stories out, including the Prescott Carmichael series. He describes them in an interview as cozy detective meets noir meets screwball comedy meets P.G. Wodehouse meets cocktail culture. We're hoping to feature one of them later this year, so stay tuned. He also has a novel out called Wrath, The Life and Assassination of a U.S. Governor, which is the story of the only U.S. governor to be assassinated whilst serving in office, apparently a man who needed to die. Howard is a financial advisor who regularly appears on radio and also is a finance journalist in the Cincinnati Enquirer. You can purchase Howard's work on Amazon, Smashwords, check out his journalistic work at examiner.com and on the Cincinnati Enquirer website, like him on Goodreads and Facebook, follow him on Twitter, and also check out his website, howardmcewen.com, which includes his blog, contact information, and some of the many varied things that hold his interest. We're lucky this week that Howard has generously agreed to narrate the story for us. So, without further ado, sit back, grab a glass of your favourite beverage, and enjoy.
Macomb County Water Tower No. 2 by Howard McEwen. Joe McManus stood 65 feet above ground on the catwalk that ringed Macomb County Water Tower No. 2. His lungs heaved and his thighs burned from the climb up. It was the second time in his life he'd made the climb. This time was much harder. His knees were stiffer, his breath didn't come back as fast. With a sigh, he bent down to pull out the first of 6 Coors Tall Boys from his backpack. He sighed again, bending back up. He chugged the beer quickly, crushed the can, and dropped it over the side. Yep, that killed me, he thought, as the can bounced off the gravel underneath the tower. The catwalk's railing had the stickiness that fresh paint on metal kept when the air was humid. He straightened up and looked out over the little valley, then up a bluff, where State Route 247 ran east to west and further up the hillside to his home. It was a modest split level, sitting on 3 acres, but he was proud that it had 4 bedrooms. He could see lights on in the upstairs living room and downstairs in one of the kids' bedrooms. Another light he must have forgotten to turn off shone through the attic window. It had to have been on since January, he thought, when he put away the Christmas ornaments. He knew the light in the attic was an 80-watt bare bulb with a metal pull chain. He knew everything about that house. He knew every outlet and every switch. He knew every plumbing fixture and drain pipe. Beneath the drywall, he knew exactly where the studs were and the R rating of the insulation he put between those studs. It's all gone to hell, he thought. He pulled out another tall boy, popped the top, and drew slowly from it. I'm 50 and it's all gone to hell, he muttered aloud. His first climb up the water tower was 33 years ago. It was graduation night. He was heading off to college in 3 months. He wasn't sure what he was going to study. He was good with drawing, drafting, and art, and thought he could do something with that. He was going to spend those 3 months until he left, working only as hard as he had to, and the rest would be beer and sun and Sandra. That graduation night, fueled by testosterone and tequila, he made the first climb up the 65 feet to the catwalk of the tower and spray-painted Jill McM, then a bit further down Sandra. In between the words, he painted a heart in red, bordered with a black spray. He took his time and shaded each word and added dimension. The huge halogen lights cast his shadow large against the water tank and exposed him to anyone driving along State Route 247 who turned her head and looked to the tower beneath between a grouping of trees. After an hour, he leaned himself back over the railing trying to take in his work. Early the next evening, he drove Sandra down State Route 247. She was nuzzled up under his arm. His arms were stronger and Sandra was thinner then. He had his left hand on the steering wheel and his right hand draped over her shoulder, cupping her right breast. He pulled his truck off to the side of the road. "What you stopping for?" she asked. He nodded to the water tower. She blushed and slapped him playfully, then cried. It was a bit of tenderness. The hard life she'd had made his tenderness that much more dear. She didn't have it too rough, but her mother had recently started caring more about booze and pills than her family. Her father had always been hard. "Take me to that place down by the river," she said. "You sure?" "Yeah, I'm ready." Joe drove Sandra to a little park that the county kept by the river. It was a dark night with only a sliver of moon hanging overhead that reflected off the moving water and the windshield of Joe's truck. Trevor was conceived that night. The coming baby nixed Joe's college plans. On the weekend, when he had planned on checking into the dormitories, he and Sandra were married in a short, angry ceremony Sandra's father paid for, and relatives on both sides boycotted. "I do," he said. "I do," she said, and they both meant it. They moved in with his parents. She worked at a laundromat until the baby came. He enrolled in tech school and worked nights and weekends pulling stumps, digging wells, and framing homes for Schwartz Construction. It was tough. He and Sandra both knew their parents, friends, and everyone else in town were betting against them. His mother and dad grimaced at him. When he told his parents the plans he and Sandra were concocting, they nodded politely, but silently. They let him know they were resigned to the inevitable divorce. He had snapped at her once, when the stress of school, scorn of parents, and the tension of sharing his childhood bedroom with his wife and baby boy got to him. "Do you still love me?" she asked. "There's a water tower off State Route 247 that says so." That made her laugh, and he laughed at himself, and they persevered. He earned his certification, got a decent job. Sandra enrolled in tech school. On the weekend after Trevor's second birthday, they moved into their own place. It was a first-floor apartment over in Dobsonville. It was concrete block construction with a slab floor and the same linoleum tile from the threshold through the family room, kitchen, two bedrooms, and bath. "It's so big," she said. "It's not so big. Trevor has his own room now, if he'll sleep in it. We have our own room now." "That's what I'm excited about," he said with a grin. Trevor, charmed by cartoon characters Sandra had cut out of old wrapping paper and taped to the walls, did sleep in his own room that night. While she was putting him down, Joe ducked out for a bottle of convenience store wine. He turned on their single-speaker FM radio. The reception faded in and out, so he ran an antenna out the window, but Patsy Cline's crazy still ebbed and flowed with the passing clouds. They ate spaghetti and red sauce, emptied the bottle of wine, and danced to the inconsistent music. Later they showered together. It was something they couldn't do while living with his parents. They splashed each other quietly so as not to wake up the baby, and made love until the water ran cold. Stacy was born 9 months later. Trevor and the new baby put Sandra's schooling on hold. She would have to put off becoming an LPN until next year. "It's only a year," they said to each other. They settled into the business of living. Alarm clock, feed the kids, off to work, come home, feed the kids, TV, bed, sleep, repeat. When times got tough, they drove down State Route 247 and looked at their love broadcasting from the water tower and grew inspired to keep walking together on their path. Joe was a hard worker, showed up on time, spoke only when needed, and didn't cause problems. He soon became a crew leader of Hobson Drilling and Excavating. Whenever there was downtime, his old boss, Schwartz, was glad to hire him for extra cash. He worked 12-hour days, 6 days a week, and on Sundays did whatever was needed at home. He loved his wife and son and daughter and wanted to give them everything. On a July day, he took them to a plot of land on a hillside. A rectangular hole had been dug and lined with a concrete foundation. "It's ours," he told Sandra as she held Stacy to her hip and Trevor scurried about. She jumped with excitement and hugged his neck and the kids, not knowing why, clapped and cheered with her. He gave her a tour of the unbuilt house he designed in his head. "Here will be our bedroom. Here's Trevor's. Here's Stacy's. Here's the guest room." He showed her where the picture window in the living room was to be. It looked down the hillside across State Route 247, and framed in the center was the water tower that still read, "Joe McM. Hart, Sandra." They moved into the house 4 months later. Except for some buddies who helped out, Joe drove every nail. He stopped working so much then. He had a wife, two kids, a home and land. Cutting back to a 5-day work week would let him enjoy it. They went on their first vacation. They went to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They couldn't afford to stay near the beach, but it was a vacation still. It had been long worked for and long dreamt about. They bought t-shirts and played miniature golf and ate too much bad food. One night, with their son and daughter fast asleep and their cares and worries conquered or forgotten, Joe and Sandra stole away and slipped into the resort's closed pool. Joe didn't care about his gut, and Sandra didn't give thought to her C-section scar. They stripped and jumped into the dark waters. 9 months later, Kevin was born. Joe McManus smiled briefly at the memory, then thought, "It's all gone to hell now." He dropped the empty tall boy over the railing. He counted the seconds until it bounced off the gravel. 6 Mississippis. The fall would crack a skull, he thought. My brains would leak all over. He dug into the backpack for another can. They were getting warm. He didn't care. His head was already buzzing. He wasn't used to drinking this much so quickly. He laid off the stuff a few years ago when he felt it getting out of hand. He wondered what Trevor was doing. Trevor got himself into college, and Joe went back to working 6 days a week to pay the tuition. The boy did good and graduated. He got a job at some financial company in Cincinnati, working on the phone, telling people something or other about their money all day long. It seemed all the town's kids were moving to Cincinnati, or Louisville, or down to Florida. Joe visited him at his office once. Trevor worked in a little cube where he'd pinned little cartoons to the wall. The boy married some girl named Jenny he met over margaritas at some Mexican chain restaurant that sat in the middle of an office park by his building. Trevor had brought her home to see the house where he grew up and to meet the family. "So what do you think, Dad?" he asked at the end of the visit. "Of what?" "Of Jenny." Joe thought of Jenny. She was a boring girl who said boring things. She had a plain face and oily hair. Joe guessed they were in love. But he didn't see the spark in either their eyes that Sandra and he had in those early days. "She seems nice, Trev. But with something like that, don't ask anyone else's opinion, not even me. No one else has to sleep next to her for the next 50 years. He meant it as good advice, but Trevor seemed to take it as a rebuke. Trevor wanted to hear how great Jenny was. Joe couldn't see anything great about her. Trevor and Jenny bought a little house in Cincinnati that seemed to be made of tissue paper with small bedrooms and a big kitchen and a lawn with drainage problems. They complained about student loans but never seemed to work more than they had to pay them down. Jenny popped out 2 kids, and Joe noticed that his daughter-in-law wore sweatpants all day, every day, everywhere. The large kitchen amused Joe because Jenny never seemed to cook. The freezer was full of boxes she'd microwave and feed to Trevor and the kids. Joe loved those kids. At least he tried to, but he felt no connection to them. They seemed like overweight little mouth breathers, playing at video games and doing nothing else. He felt horrible every time he thought that, but they looked as if they never threw a ball, ran in the yard, or gave a good honest laugh. Joe and Sandra drove to Cincinnati on the youngest grandkid's 2nd birthday. Trevor was showing Joe a new video game. Joe, bored, rose to use the bathroom. "Use the one in our room, Dad. The main one doesn't work." Joe went into their bedroom, stepped over piles of laundry, did his thing, then went to the main bath. He started to take off the tank lid. Trevor leaned in. "I'll get a plumber out when I can, Dad. We're just a little short right now." "Plumber? Even look in the tank?" "No, Dad, I got no time," Trevor said before going back to his video game. Joe pulled off the tank lid. "Jesus, son, it's just a broken chain," he thought. Joe left Trevor's house without a goodbye and drove to the local hardware store. Bought a flapper with attached chain, came home and fixed the toilet. How the hell did his oldest son think, he asked himself then, and still asks himself now. The lights around the water tower grew brighter as the night became darker. Joe threw the empty tall boy at one of the lights. It bounced off harmlessly and fell to the ground. Sandra knew he didn't have much respect for Trevor. It was another brick in the wall built between them. Sometime, somewhere over the years, things got distant between Sandra and him. He accepted blame. He worked a lot, and when he wasn't working, he plugged himself into the TV. But something in her grew hard, too. Maybe it was her family. They were hard. Maybe it was dealing with the kids all the time. Maybe it was the constant scratching for money in those first 15 years or so that killed the fun girl he married. Either way, at some point, the tenderness between them was gone. They both knew it, but didn't acknowledge it in one another. He pulled another can out of the backpack, but at least Trevor seemed to be building a life for himself, even if Joe didn't understand why he wanted that life. He wasn't sure about Stacy. She'd never dated in high school. She didn't go to her proms. Even through his father's eyes, she was an unattractive girl who was hippie in the 7th grade and grew hippier in high school, and was just plain fat-assed afterwards. Her chest never developed, her shoulders slouched, and the combination was not anything he knew any boys looked for. She was on the carrier in a Gulf now. At least he thought she was in the Gulf. She worked as a Navy cook. She'd been in for 6 years, and the few times they did talk, she didn't seem to want more than to be a cook. She hadn't been home in quite some time. When she was 2 years in, she called to say she got some liberty and would be home for 2 weeks and was bringing a guy she met and wanted Joe and Sandra to meet. Maybe Sandra knew, but she didn't tell Joe. The guy Stacy brought home was a foreign guy named Abdul. Abdul, for Christ's sake, he thought. Abdul was born in Dearborn, Michigan, but anyone named Abdul was a foreigner to Joe. He knew he didn't handle it well, but thought he did okay considering the surprise. Stacy shouldn't have been annoyed with him. She knew him. She should have thanked God her bigoted grandfather was dead. Abdul seemed slow, but nice enough. He was in the Navy, too, not doing much either. Joe retreated to his shop and puttered around while the two visited with Sandra. He came in for meals, but couldn't bring himself to acknowledge the boy as they sat around the table. Stacy came out once to talk to Joe in his shop, and Joe cut her short. Her being in love with someone named Abdul wasn't something he wanted to hear about. After 5 days, Stacy ended her planned 2 weeks at home and spent the rest of her liberty in Norfolk with Abdul. Sandra yelled at him about that. "I never get a chance to see my daughter, Joe, never. And you chased her away." "I didn't say anything. Nothing. Not a thing." "Exactly. Your silence is louder than your yell." A few weeks later, Sandra told him Stacy wrote her to say she and Abdul had broken up. Maybe it was Stacy's one shot at happiness. Sandra seemed to think so. Sandra pinned her daughter's unhappiness on Joe. A girl shouldn't need her father's approval of the man she loves, but Stacy did. Sandra and he argued over it time and again, but there was no point to bickering anymore. The boy was gone, and Stacy would have to move on, but she couldn't seem to. Sandra drove out to Norfolk 3 months ago to meet Stacy. Joe didn't go. Sandra told him Stacy had put on weight and couldn't get it off and was in danger of being kicked out of the Navy for it. "It's all gone to hell," he thought. The last of the warm beer tasted like spit as he drained the can. He let the can slip from his fingers and didn't watch it land. It would be so easy to slip, he thought. To slip right over. He just wanted his life back. He wanted that feeling back where Sandra and he were happy and the world was nothing but possibility and so much of their life was free and open. Too much was set in concrete now. The inertia of habit and age had set in. He grabbed another can out of the bag. The night was getting hot and he had downed half of it with a gulp. Sandra asked him to go over to Steubenville tomorrow. It wasn't something he was looking forward to. Kevin was there and needed straightening out. But he was 22 now, and Joe wasn't sure what Sandra wanted him to do. The boy was always tough. He got his first arrest at 16. "You're hanging out with the wrong crowd," Joe explained. "I am the wrong crowd," Kevin said, as he opened the fridge, grabbed one of Joe's beers, popped the top, and downed it while his father watched. He dropped out of high school, and when he gave him an ultimatum to shape up or get out, Kevin got out. He moved in with a buddy of his, and rumors were they were making money selling pot they grew somewhere. Sandra heard it from two ladies in her prayer group. Joe worried they'd move on to some harder stuff. He read every article about meth that was in the newspaper, fearful of reading his own last name. Kevin hadn't been around in a while. He was always a difficult boy. The kids were Sandra's department, and he only stepped in when needed. When Kevin was a teen, Joe was busy working to pay Trevor's schooling, and that, Joe thought, allowed Sandra to baby her baby too much. He did have a certain respect for Kevin. The kid never asked for money. He was feeding himself somehow. They bumped into one another at a big box hardware store once. Joe was buying a new pipe auger and Kevin was buying PVC. He didn't ask Kevin what he was working on. They met like two men who were once intimate friends, but had chosen to drift apart. "Buy you lunch?" Joe felt he had to ask. Kevin grinned the same shit-eating grin he'd had since he was a kid and said, "Sure." They sat down, and the waitress took their order, and they still hadn't spoken 10 words to one another. Joe looked around the diner. He'd like to have a place like this of his own. A little place where he could cook for his friends. He enjoyed cooking up meals. Maybe something to do in retirement. Something to get him out of the house. "Not going to ask about your mom?" "How's Mom, Pops?" he asked. Kevin always called him Pops. Nobody around here did that. It was Dad, maybe Pa, or Daddy out in the country. "She's good." Kevin just grinned at him. Joe took a gulp of coffee. "I hear you sell marijuana, that true?" Kevin pulled a long drag off his cola through a red and white striped straw. "Don't ask questions you don't want to hear answers to, Pops." Joe stared into his coffee. "I wonder where I went wrong with you kids," he said. "That's your problem, Pops. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm me. 100% me." Kevin stood up, pulled out a roll of bills, peeled off a 20, and dropped it on the table. "I gotta run, Pops. No time for lunch, but have some on me. I'll see you around." He knew he built his family a house, kept them fed, and educated the ones that wanted educating. But when things seemed bad, like they were going to hell, he'd sit in his living room, look out across State Route 247, and see that Joe M. heart Sandra. That was the thing he could hold on to. Joe M. hearted Sandra. He clung to that. He clung to that even when he and Sandra didn't speak for days in the empty, quiet house he built for her and she kept for him. He clung to that. Other boys had climbed the ladder and stood on the catwalk and spray-painted their own emotions on the tower. Someone celebrated a basketball championship a few years ago by writing "Go Cats" in an ugly, uneven scrawl. Something he thought was a gang symbol appeared last fall, but he still could read, "Joe M. hearted Sandra." He clung to that. Joe McManus never liked Lloyd Jennings. Lloyd was a county commissioner with more gut than brains who drove down State Route 247 on his way to and from town. Lloyd got tired of seeing the mess of graffiti on the water tower against the Kentucky landscape. Lloyd created a line item in the county's building and maintenance budget and obtained federal matching funds for repainting the Macomb County Water Tower No. 2. A contractor was selected. A work crew was hired, and early on a Tuesday morning, Joe McM. Hart Sander was painted over in eggshell white. It seemed to happen overnight. Joe noticed it this morning. He stood in his living room, dressed for work, looking at the new paint gleaming white across the little valley. He felt himself unmoored. Joe McM. Hart Sander had been blotted out. Sander walked through the room. She stopped and followed his gaze. He sensed her stifle a small sob, and she quickly brushed past him toward her sewing room. She closed the door. That was this morning. Joe belched. He flipped the empty tall boy to his side. It clattered along the catwalk and came to a rest on the edge, threatening to fall off. He walked over and nudged it with the toe of his boot. It fell so simply, so easily, and was gone into the darkness below. He walked over to his backpack and fished out the last tall boy. The other cans in the bag rattled against one another. "I'll have to make this one last," he thought. "My last beer." Sandra McManus stood in her living room the next day. She hadn't been able to look out the large window since she noticed the water tower had been painted. When she first saw it, she pulled the drapes closed to block it out. The old water tower had grown ugly with rust and graffiti, but it told her every day in her life that whether the times were good or hard times, that she was loved, or at least had been loved. Now times weren't so much hard as lonesome. During those lonesome days, the water tower was there to remind her that at one point in her life, she was happy, and life was full of promise. Now all that was blotted out in eggshell white, gleaming from a hillside. But this morning, she told herself she'd have to face it. There was no use hiding from the life she'd made. There was no use hiding from failed dreams. She pulled open the drapes, and sunlight flooded the room, highlighting the dust in the air. Her pupils contracted suddenly, and she put her hands to her eyes. He stirred from his chair where he had spent the night. He was doing that more and more often nowadays. He stunk a beer, and she had no interest in looking at him. It wasn't so much that he put on weight. It was that he didn't look at her the same way. She couldn't stand him looking at her as just another person, not when his face used to light up with love when she walked into the room. "You like?" he asked. She forced herself to look toward him. His eyes were red and runny like when he used to be a drinker. "Like what?" she snapped. He nodded his head toward the window. Her eyes adjusted to the light, and then she saw it. Fresh on the eggshell white and black and red was Joe McM, Stillheart Sander McM. She turned to him and smiled. She felt like she was an 18-year-old girl again. Joe thought she looked it. Her hardness melted away. Each of them giggled. They hugged, and the hug turned to a kiss. Then they made love on the floor of their living room, stealing moments to glance out the window at Macomb County Water Tower number 2.
Thank you, Howard, for contributing that for us. It's very much appreciated. I don't know about you, but I've been in many discussions with other romance lovers, and there is a common lament on the lack of stories told from the male perspective. That was actually one of the contributing factors, I think, to my enjoyment of the story, and also my inclusion of it here at RomPod. It also brought tears to my eyes. Twice. Macomb County Water Tower No. 2 is a counterpoint to Howard's forthcoming novel, Daddy Issues, which features this week's protagonist, Joe McManus, as a minor character. However, Daddy Issues is a tragedy, so please bear that in mind. We had a comment last week from Andrea Wilson, who wrote that she really enjoyed my reading voice. Thank you very much. And she loved the storyline so much that it made her want to hop onto the next cruise to leave Miami, especially to attend the next Slam Jam. Maybe you'll see Dee there, Andrea. Jump on to rompod.com where you can subscribe, locate the show notes, follow links to our featured authors. You can also leave comments, which I'll read out if I can. We are currently looking for more authors and narrators, so if you'd like to be a part of RomPod, please contact me, amanda.rompod@gmail.com. Special thanks to my husband, Simon, whose continued support has made this project both easier and more professional than I could have achieved alone. That's it from me. I've been your host, Amanda McCall. Thanks for joining me, and we'll be back next week with our next story, Impulse Control, by Suzanne Bischoff. Please remember, whenever you can, share the love. This podcast is shared under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. You may distribute, display, and copy this work, but not for commercial use. You may not alter, transform, or build upon this work in any way. And if you use it, you must link to the original work. The stories within remain copyright of the authors. RomPod is created using the Audacity editing software. The music used in each episode is sampled from Tango di Manzana by Kevin MacLeod. Find his work on incompetech.com.